Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Wall Street is going to Washington on Monday. Citigroup and J.P. Morgan and all the rest are meeting with the president. You could call it a high-level trip to the woodshed, I think. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by Bank of America, 1 year into a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low to moderate income communities.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 11th of December today, and it is great to have you here. I don't know if you're going to remember this, but the last time Wall Street went to Washington en masse, we got the TARP, then Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, Ben Bernanke from the Fed, and not least Timothy Geithner, then the head of the New York Fed, sat almost a dozen bank CEOs down and basically forced them to take bailout money. In their meeting with President Obama that's coming up this Monday, the bankers aren't going to be getting any new cash. They will be getting a going over, though. The president's going to ask a question a lot of people seem to have. Why aren't you lending more? And then he's going to sweeten the deal for banks that make loans to small businesses. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
To generate more lending for credit-starved small businesses, the Treasury Department wants to prime the pump with money left over in the Troubled Asset Relief Program. It would give banks TARP money to lend to small businesses. Congressional supporters, including Virginia's Democratic Senator Mark Warner, say banks have to get over their stigma of TARP money.
I do think some of the particularly community-based banks are feeling like taking TARP funds makes them toxic.
Warner agrees with Treasury's idea of setting up a separate fund with a different name. Treasury is also willing to waive some of the conditions that are imposed on TARP recipients, like salary caps. Consumer groups, though, aren't sure that's necessary. Gail Hillebrand is with Consumers Union.
If any conditions are lifted, there should be a very specific set of requirements. What do they have to do? How much credit by what date? Because one thing we're seeing on the mortgage modification side is the banks say they'll get in the program, but the results are slow to come out the other end.
The Obama administration says easing restrictions is necessary to generate small business loans. But are small businesses really clamoring for credit? Not according to Mike Miller, the CEO of Community One Bank in Asheboro, North Carolina.
What we're seeing is really not a great deal of demand for small business credit. In an economy that's operated like this one has for the past 18 months, people may not be as credit worthy as they have been.
But that's just what Treasury wants, banks to lend to businesses they've been leery of lending to. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Ben Bernanke said the other day that the recession is technically over already, which is great. But some new numbers suggest that we are not the only ones. The Chinese economy will probably grow more than 8% this year. Both factory production and retail sales there were much better than expected. And last quarter, India showed its fastest growth in a year and a half. We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to find out what that means for us.
China and India are both outstripping the U.S. right now, and not just in terms of the amount of stuff their factories are producing. They're growing a lot faster than we are, too. James Barth is a fellow at the Milken Institute, and he says it's okay for America not to be first all the time.
Because it obviously keeps world economic growth higher than it otherwise would be and benefits other countries as well. It doesn't hurt the United States to have other countries pick up some of the slack when the U.S. is encountering difficulties.
The middle classes in India and China are bigger than the entire population of the U.S., so more growth there means more growth here.
They represent potential economic growth because of all their people that are working in those two countries, as well as potential consumers of goods produced in countries like the United States.
But this isn't just about Indians and Chinese buying more of the things Americans make. Rapid growth creates opportunities for American companies in those countries. Jayashankar Swaminathan is a professor at UNC Chapel Hill. He says in India, for example, the urban populations are growing very fast.
What this means is the cities need to be developed, the roads need to be developed, and infrastructure needs to grow along with that. Now, this is where I think the opportunities are going to be pretty huge.
He says that's because there aren't very many Indian companies that are prepared to do projects like build power plants and bridges, areas in which many American companies specialize. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a not-so-bad ending to kind of a humdrum week. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Sometimes our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond is more about the Wall Street part. Sometimes it's more about the Beyond part. Today, I think it's going to be a little bit of both. To help us out, we've got Felix Salmon with us from Reuters, also John Carney from ClusterStock.com. Gentlemen, good to talk to you both again.
Good to talk to you, Kay.
Thanks for having us.
We are going to dip in and out of the week that was today, guys. And Felix, we're going to start with you. And Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner a couple of days ago says, yes, I would like to keep the TARP going for another 10 months. You surprised by that at all?
Not in the slightest. It's one of these things where you need to keep the momentum going, otherwise you just precipitate another horrible downward lurch. It's quite sad. I mean, it's just the same as the zero interest rates from the Fed. What they're doing is they're really accelerating and putting everything they can in terms of fiscal policy and monetary policy. They're spending money, they're keeping interest rates low, just to keep our heads above water. If they stopped doing that, we would sink.
All right, but John, don't we have to at some point start having the government pull back here a little bit?
We do need to have the government pull back. The problem is everybody in Washington is afraid of exactly what Felix was saying, that if they even start talking about pulling back at some point, that will cause a panic. We're held together with bare thread, and people are really worried that if you pull on it just a little bit, the whole thing will unravel.
Felix, on the topic of Washington, D.C., the president made an economic speech a couple of days ago that has largely left things kind of flat. I mean, it was subsumed by his Nobel speech and all that. But what was your take on his pledges to help small business and we're going to do all we can to create jobs here?
It's more of the same. I didn't notice any actual substantive policy proposals there. And in any case, the fact is that there's so much backlog of stuff which needs to get through Congress in terms of regulatory reform, not to mention healthcare, that the chances of any legislation being enacted are pretty slim. Now, Tim Geithner does want to use some of the TARP money, which is being paid back by the big banks, and use that for smaller banks and small businesses and that kind of thing. We'll see whether that's possible and or successful. I have my doubts.
Well, if that's the case, guys, if we're using phrases like panic and the White House doing everything it can, where are we in terms of ever seeing the end of this mess, John?
I made a prediction a few weeks ago that we would be out of the financial crisis by June 14th, 2011.
That's right.
And I think we are building towards a healthier economy in spite of everything that the government's doing. It's not so much that they're fixing things, but people are buying things again. People, you know, stores are packed. I just ate lunch at a Midtown restaurant in Manhattan that was packed to the gills. I was lucky to get a seat. And so, you know, people are out there, and I think the economy is showing some signs of life.
But only because the government is in up to its eyeballs, right, Felix?
Correct. The reason the Midtown restaurants in Manhattan are packed is because the banking industry is making money hand over fist because of those 0% interest rates. Out in the real world, there's still a huge amount of pain, and the real economy still has double-digit unemployment rates. It's still very hard to get credit if you're not a very big company, if you're just an individual or a small business. It's a very broken system right now.
Let me ask you about the stock market. I mean, not that that is the economy, but it does sort of seem to have been stuck in one place for a number of weeks. Is there anything we can read from that, John?
Well, this was the most hated rally in the history. Everybody despised the fact that the stock stock market kept going up. And at some point, I think all of that negative sentiment had to, you know, start to affect the market. Right now, people made a lot of money if they got long the market any time in the last 6 months. And I think what we're seeing right now in the stocks is people saying, I don't need to risk anything more. I'm not going to go, you know, start buying things. I have till the end of the year, and then I can start to reinvest again. I think we're going to see another rally in the beginning of the year when professional money managers have to start putting money to work again.
Felix Hammond from Reuters. John Carney at ClusterStock.com. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Guy.
As our man in Copenhagen, Stephen Beard, told us yesterday, there's a whole lot more going on at the climate summit than just a bunch of people sitting around talking policy. There are protests and skeptics and side conferences, too. One of the bigger sideline events is a meeting of mayors from around the world early next week, because whatever global deal does or doesn't get done in Copenhagen, a lot of the really hard work is going to happen on a much more micro level in states and provinces and cities and towns. From Copenhagen, commentator Alex Steffen says now more than ever, acting globally means acting locally.
How do we fight climate change? Most of us have heard about engineering fixes like swapping coal plants and SUVs with wind turbines and hybrid cars. Clean energy and green tech are critical, but they're being eclipsed by a more system-wide approach, building bright green cities. Cities offer us powerful leverage on our most stubborn, wasteful practices. Long commutes in our cars, big power bills from our energy-hogging buildings, shopping trips to buy stuff that'll spend a few short months in our homes and long centuries in our landfills. These are unsustainable behaviors, and they're so difficult to change because they're spun into the very fabric of our cities and sprawling suburbs. Reweave that fabric, and we find change much easier. For example, start building homes together in compact, walkable neighborhoods, and suddenly people don't drive as much. Upgrade our energy systems with high-tech monitoring, and people start living more energy-efficient lives by default rather than exception. Innovations like zero-energy buildings and post-ownership consumption sound complicated, but in reality their meaning is simple. We now know how to deliver a higher standard of living with dramatically lower ecological impacts. The future of cities can be both bright and green. And that's critical, because the world is building cities faster than ever. Billions of young people are leaving their villages, seeking better lives in the emerging megacities of the global south. If we can't find a way to meet their needs sustainably, no climate treaty will help us. But if we in the global north can reinvent our cities, we will not only slash our own pollution, but provide a pathway to sustainable prosperity for the rest of the world too. And that, in turn, means markets for these innovations and billions of new customers. Develop bright green urban solutions, and we may not only save the planet, but find the 21st century's best business opportunities in the bargain.
Alex Steffen is the author of World Changing, A User's Guide to the 21st Century. Send us your thoughts when you get a minute about changing the world or anything else. Our website is marketplace.org. And while you're there, you can hear and see the rest of our climate coverage from Copenhagen and elsewhere. I don't know if it's $3 gas or just wanting to get out of the car and get some exercise, but biking to work is as popular now as it's ever been. And a lot of cities are trying to accommodate the two-wheelers. Washington, D.C. has a brand new bicycle transit center where you can lock your wheels, change your clothes, even fix a flat tire. In Portland, Oregon, they're taking away car parking spaces and giving them to bike riders. And today in New York City, a new law lets people bring their bikes into office buildings. They may be inside, but Andrea Bernstein reports now from WNYC, some cyclists will still be left out in the cold.
To celebrate the new law, a group of real estate developers recently threw a party at a new office building in Lower Manhattan. The last few years have been a party for New York bike commuters. The city has added hundreds of miles of bike lanes, and bike commuting has jumped about 60% since 2006. Attorney Steve Vaccaro even got a green light from his Midtown law firm to bring his bike into the office. But the owners of the building said, no dice. Ricaro had to keep his bike outside.
I've lost, you know, a number of bikes. I've had the rear skewer stolen from my wheel. I actually had my brake pads stolen once.
Under the new law, buildings have to allow bikes inside common areas and freight elevators. John Sanosky manages several large buildings. He says requiring bike access wasn't too popular in his industry at first.
Because it's just something added that we have to do. And it was all being negotiated in a down market, and just we didn't need it.
In between bites of a canapé, Sanosky says now that the law is here, he plans to use it to his advantage.
Ultimately, this will be helpful because it'll be something else we can offer tenants and hopefully fill up some of our empty space.
Over in Brooklyn, cyclist Amy Cohen says she was excited when the law passed in October.
I thought it meant automatically that 60 days later I could bring in my now new bike.
But there's a catch. Building managers have to allow bikes to pass through common areas. But employers don't have to allow those bikes into the offices they lease.
I work for a nonprofit, and there is not a lot of space. And they've just decided that people can't do that. And I have several colleagues who would have biked to work if that had been possible. So it's pretty frustrating.
Back at the party to celebrate the law, New York City Councilmember David Yaski acknowledges it's not perfect.
Progress is one step at a time. This is a really good step forward.
Or maybe a giant turn of the wheel. In New York, I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace.
Coming up, collecting in this economy.
Yeah, well, it's about passion and emotion. Nobody really needs any of this stuff. They want it. It touches a chord for them. You remember that Hot Wheels car, you know, from the 70s?
I do. I do indeed. But first, let's do the numbers. Two up, one down today gets us the happy music. The Dow Industrials jumped 65 points, 2/3 of 1%, closed at 10,471. The NASDAQ basically flat, ended at 2190. The S&P 500 ticked up 4 points, 1/3 of 1%, finished at 1106. For the week, the Dow put on 3/4 of 1%. The NASDAQ off 0.1%. The S&P 500 flat, it added just 0.04 of 1%. Encouraging reports on consumer sentiment and retail sales helped push the Dow to its highest level this year. Walt Disney paraded a 1.2% gain. General Electric plugged in an extra 2% today. Alcoa rolled up 8.2% this Friday in December. Analysts expected bigger profits as metal prices climb. Century Aluminum constructed a 9.8% gain. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.55%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. By Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. And by Bank of America, 1 year into a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low to moderate income communities. How will climate change affect where you live? Go to marketplace.org/climate and click on the map. You'll also find dramatic photos of the impact of climate change from around the world, plus all the stories from our series, The Climate Race.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The U.S. Energy Information Administration releases its annual energy outlook. It forecasts energy supply, demand, and prices to 2035. President Obama is scheduled to meet with the President of Lebanon at the White House. And George Washington, the first U.S. president, was 67 when he died at his Mount Vernon home on December 14, 1799. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There was a promising report out on retail sales this morning. The Commerce Department, the Census Bureau specifically, told us that sales jumped a way better than expected, 1.3%. Nice. Not really the whole story, though. As economic indicators go, business inventories probably are not the most exciting thing you ever heard about. But that is where we're going to go today, because after more than a year of cutting back, business owners have started restocking their shelves. Our New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott explains why that bodes so well for the economy.
We're not talking any miracles here. Inventories grew by just 0.2%. But after 13 months of declines, forecaster Lakshman Acheathan says it's a good sign.
It's a very good sign, because when businesses ramp up inventories, that's in essence new orders going out across the country.
That means eventually factories start humming again and businesses start hiring people to make and sell all that stuff. Acheathan predicts the economy will start creating jobs again in the next couple of months. Louise Castle isn't there yet. She co-owns Kinetic Systems Bicycles in Clarkston, Michigan. She says she'd love to buy more stock. Problem is, she just doesn't have the cash right now. She is optimistic about the spring and summer, though.
We just really have a good sense about next year. Continuing to be a strong year, so we've actually placed larger orders for next year.
Castle says customers seem to have a better attitude about the economy lately. The numbers back her up. Not only did retail sales rise more than expected last month, Reuters and the University of Michigan say consumer sentiment is up too. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
So companies have been drawing down inventories for a year or more to save money. They have also been drawing down employee costs. Millions of people, as you know, have been laid off. And many of those who were lucky enough to avoid a pink slip saw their benefits, everything from health care to matching contributions to their 401ks, cut back as well. There is a little bit of good news on that score to tell you about. Some companies have started resurrecting the benefits they scrapped a year ago. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports.
In the teeth of the recession, companies took a big bite out of benefits. They cut salaries, eliminated raises, and cut their 401k matching plans. That's where employers match employee contributions to retirement savings up to a certain point. FedEx was one of those companies. Jess Bunn is a spokesperson for FedEx.
We hated to do it, but we were really forced to do it to minimize the job loss and to really position the company for future growth.
That growth is here, and starting January 1st, FedEx will start 401k matching again. So will more than a third of companies that cut those contributions, including American Express, 7-Eleven, and Motorola. Lisa Alcon is with human resources consulting firm Towers Perrin. She says as the economy starts to recover, companies have to restore benefits to stay competitive.
It is almost viewed as an entitlement by employees. Also, it's a real question of talent management.
But Alcon says those matching plans look a little different this time around. Many are now tied to company performance, and others are lower than they used to be. FedEx, for example, is matching at half the level it did a couple of years ago. Still, contributions of any size are important, says Joellen Lavelle with the Pension Rights Center.
It can cause the employee to not want to contribute anymore because a lot of times they're contributing just to get the employer match.
Consulting firm Towers Perrin says about half the companies they surveyed also plan to reverse salary and hiring freezes in the next 6 months. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
One person's junk, the saying goes, is another person's treasure. Different way to put that is that there's no accounting for taste. That's the basic premise behind a television show that's been on the air for more than a decade now.
I bought it in a consignment shop, and
what this is was a purposefully made fake in the 1920s. That's why they put the dirt on it. That's why they put the slip on it, and they wore the slip off.
If you think that cross stitch your great-grandma did 100 years ago might be worth something, Antiques Roadshow is the place for you. The show's executive producer has a new behind-the-scenes book out, and we got to thinking that maybe the roadshow and the collectibles industry writ large might be a decent gauge of how people have been handling the recession. Executive producer Marsha Bemko says that for starters, the roadshow has never seen crowds like it has the past year or two.
Especially when we're in an area that has had some real economic impact, for instance, when we're in Mobile, and people were talking to us about needing to have objects that would give them some financial return.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but more than 8 million people have been put out of work over the past 2 years. That is a whole lot of people with more time to go treasure hunting in their own homes. David Margulies from Collectors Weekly says all those folks digging around in their attics and their basements makes for more stuff hitting the market. Lots more stuff.
Antique fishing wars, comic books, clocks, china, baseball, football stuff, art glass. Art glass is gigantic.
What's selling, though, isn't always what you'd expect.
Yeah, well, it's about passion and emotion. Nobody really needs any of this stuff. They want it. It touches a chord for them. You remember that Hot Wheels car, you know, from the 70s?
Yeah.
We do. But we don't remember that thing from 1873 necessarily.
At his auction house, iGavel.com, roadshow appraiser Lark Mason says he sees a little bit of everything.
It's a bit of a rabbit's warren here. Okay, so this is, you know, we've got 20 trays containing several hundred snuff bottles, jade belt buckles.
Mason says you can draw a straight line from the collectibles market to the health of the economy.
The middle market still sells, but it's selling for substantially less than it did a year or two or 5 years ago. It's the same people that have the houses that are worth less than they had been, and their mortgages are underwater, and they're just, they don't have that discretionary income to go out and buy decorative items.
A lot of what is selling gives you a pretty good clue as to who's up and who's down globally.
The top end of the market has been and is continuing to get stronger. In certain segments, such as Chinese art, there is a huge demand. So it's sort of indicative of the strength of the Asian economies. So a good portion of what I sell back to China.
While some of Mason's items are headed east, most of what is appraised on the Antiques Roadshow doesn't ever go up for sale. Producer Marcia Bemko says stuff just means more than cash to a whole lot of people.
It really isn't about the money, and we know that. First, people walk away. Most of the people who come to Antiques Roadshow are going to learn their objects are worth $100 or less, but they walk away satisfied, and they've learned something new. And for those owners who we have met and who have gotten fabulous, fantastic financial news from us, we know most of them don't part with their objects after getting the news.
Recession or not, a big chunk of the collectibles market is kind of like those Visa commercials. That old painting your grandma left you? About $150. Emotional value, priceless.
Marketplace is supported by Mars. For generations, Mars has been making real chocolate from 100% pure cocoa butter. More at MarsHealthyLiving.com. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, I don't know if it's come across on the air or not, but in our editorial meetings the past couple of months, I've kind of been harping on a theme that a year or more after Lehman Brothers collapsed, with banks once again profitable and the stock market up 40% from the lows it hit in March, what we've had here is a crisis wasted, that all the momentum there was earlier this year for meaningful reforms evaporated as the economy improved. On that score this afternoon, we have this news. Today, the House of Representatives passed its version of new regulations for the financial industry. It was close. 223 to 202 was the final vote. The Senate is still working on its bill. And on this Friday, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow packed on 65 points, two-thirds of 1%. The Nasdaq basically flat for the day. The S&P 500 bumped up 4 points, a third of 1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Ure. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, you're wondering where to give your time and your money? Well, that question is as old as giving itself.
Ultimately, what is philanthropy? There are choices between right and right. Very difficult choices between right and right.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are back here Monday afternoon. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media. all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.